Good morning. The panel was previously introduced. I want to remind you to pay attention to your time clocks, 15 minutes each as far as presentation of your case, with 5 minutes allotted to appellant counsel for rebuttal. Please remember to state your name and indicate the party you're speaking on behalf of when you begin your presentation. And I will ask our marshal to call the next case for court consideration.
A23-0534, MCY Appellant versus State of Minnesota Respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Wilson. I represent Appellant MCY.
Now that you've been introduced, it's an expungement case. Isn't there a way that this can be resolved short of Court of Appeals argument and continuing requirements by this court to answer the issues?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the respondent's argument concerning MCY's eligibility for expungement under the new version of the law is actually correct. My read of the new law related to stays of imposition is that there is a typo. I believe the intent of the legislature is that stays of imposition like MCY's are going to be eligible for expungement in the future. But if the court reads the 2023 version of that statute, the stays of imposition subdivision references the same list of 50 felony offenses, I believe it's parent 8, in 609A. So I think it's a typo, but if I were to go back to the district court right now and petition for an expungement, the district court would be well within its rights to deny that.
So our mystery in terms of why you just don't refile has now been answered. Thank you.
Have you asked the state whether they would oppose a petition for expungement if it were refiled?
Not on this file, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I have not. I expect...
We'll find out in about 15 minutes whether they would.
And I'm hopeful we'll get the answer that I'm looking for. There was extensive briefing. I don't need to belabor most of the points that I raised in the briefing. I think we submitted 100 pages. To the state's credit, they submitted a fairly comprehensive response. Two arguments that I'd like to focus on. Number one is just that we weren't afforded a hearing on remand. And the second, I'd like to touch on the constitutional rights infringement, because there is an absence of appellate case law in Minnesota dealing with what exactly constitutes a serious infringement of an individual's constitutional rights for purposes of a judicial inherent authority expungement. In terms of the hearing on remand, I think there are two main issues, or rather two main ways in which the district court abuses discretion in not affording us a hearing. I have personally represented individuals on remand from this court in State versus DVL, in which this court explicitly held that on remand the district court was only to review the expungement petition and make a determination. Same district court, same referee afforded us a hearing. At that hearing, there was additional testimony that was given. The record was supplemented, despite the explicit guidance from this court stating only review the petition and make a decision. When this court last reversed and remanded MCY's request for an expungement, what the court held was much more broad in the face of an active dispute over eligibility. It wasn't just a legal decision, it wasn't a factual decision, it was both. And the court's explicit guidance on remand was, district court, you need to, quote, assess the evidence and find facts establishing the amount involved in the forgery conviction. That was, quote, in the face of a factual dispute over the amount of the forgery offense to which he pleaded guilty, and it was exposed by the record. We weren't afforded a hearing on remand, despite that at oral argument last time we were here, minutes before coming before the court, opposing counsel, rather a different attorney with the same office, provided us with a printout of a non-public version of the MCRO Register of Actions that purportedly the district court relied on. To date, I still have not seen what the district court relied on in ruling that there's a notation in this filing system. I've seen something similar in the now public version of MCRO, but I'm not sure if that's accurate. And there was, as of the last time we were at an oral argument before your honors, there was an active dispute over the legitimacy of that notation. And there's case law certainly that says that register of actions can be considered a part of the record. We don't dispute that. But considering notations in a register of actions, considering an electronic notation in MCRO or the MPA filing system, is far different than knowing that there's an actual valid basis behind that notation. Certainly you can consider it, but this court's directive in remanding was to assess the evidence and find facts establishing the amount. And a single notation that doesn't have a documentary basis, a notation that doesn't have an evidentiary basis or something you can point to, that establishes nothing. So relying on that on remand was an abuse of discretion because it's simply saying notation is there in the face of an active challenge that we're saying that notation that you're relying on doesn't have a documentary basis and it's wrong. It is false. A hearing would have aided us to flesh that issue out before the district court. A hearing would have been helpful in following this court's guidance in assessing the evidence, in finding those facts.
And what would you have done at this hearing? What evidence would you have presented at this hearing?
Our intent, Your Honor, was to issue a subpoena to a man named Andrew Matheson, who's a technical lead worker with Hennepin County. His name is in our addendum. He is the individual that sent us the email now 2.5 years ago stating that the records that we sought to obtain were destroyed despite the records retention schedule binding the district court to keep those records into perpetuity. So our intent...
You're talking about the plea petition?
The plea petition, yes, Your Honor. So our intent, given this factual dispute over the notation, was to subpoena him, and if he wasn't going to be the actual source of the knowledge, somebody in a similar capacity, to discuss the evolution of the filing programs. Because
you weren't able to present this?
No.
You weren't, I mean, as like an offer of proof of what you would present as far as testimony?
We attempted to make an offer of proof through our motion for reconsideration of the district court's denial. We attached 6 exhibits to that.
Including the proposed proffered testimony.
Not the proffered testimony, but...
What I'm getting at is if you're telling us stuff outside of the record.
Sure. Yep. The exhibits were the printout of the now public version of the MCRO Register of Actions that does include this notation, and then all of the other versions of the Registers of Actions that preceded MCRO, including MPA, TPA, the courthouse version of the MPA Register of Actions, and none of those prior records included this notation, which leads us to believe, based on the only document that's still available that has this notation, it's the complaint, that leads us to believe that the information that's in MCRO is a product of taking the sentencing provision in the complaint and simply inputting it into a new program. And under State versus ASR, reliance on the complaint of proof of a fact determining expungement eligibility or ineligibility was clear error. So that's our position. We would have subpoenaed that individual to testify about the evolution of these systems, the timeline for when they were implemented. At the time that MCY Pledden was convicted, there's a chance that his records were all paper copies anyways. It may have preceded the point in time when the judiciary transitioned into using an electronic filing system for the majority of the cases, or it may have been on the cusp. And at the review hearing before Judge Brennan, MCY provided additional information that the hardships that he's facing because of this really only came about in 2015 to 2018, approximately, which coincidentally is the time that MCRO began coming into effect. And so that's the point in time when the transition between MPA to MCRO started happening. MPA did not contain the notation. The predecessor did not contain the notation. MCRO comes into effect, and all of a sudden, this notation is there. All of a sudden, the hardships that MCY has been experiencing are exacerbated. He'd been deemed a felon based on this conviction for years, since 2006, but he wasn't facing the same level of hardships until those programs went into effect. And that seems too much like a coincidence. And it certainly was an abuse of discretion not to give me a hearing to flesh that out further, especially given that the first time the appellant and counsel found out that there was a non-public version of MCRO that the state had been relying on and the district court had been relying on was at oral argument the first time we were on appeal. It seems wrong that in remanding this, given the complicated record, given 3 years of litigation, there's a summary denial 29 days before this court even issues judgment on its opinion. And then we're on a review hearing to the district court, and you can't supplement the record at a review hearing. The district court judge at that review hearing acknowledged there was a live dispute over all of this, and yet that district court judge affirmed the referee and didn't give us a hearing. So I think that's an abuse of discretion, both because it's arbitrary, and the DVL was given a hearing and MCY was not, despite that MCY had a far more comprehensive instruction from this court on remand, but also because it would have helped the district court follow this court's guidance.
What were the instructions on remand, though?
In this case?
Yeah.
The instructions were to assess the evidence and find facts establishing the amount involved in the forgery conviction.
Okay, and it didn't say anything about a rehearing or an additional.
And certainly.
So the district court did follow the direction from the Court of Appeals, right?
No.
It did not?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I don't think relying on a notation establishes the amount in a forgery conviction. Relying on a notation establishes that there's a notation, but it doesn't establish the amount in the forgery conviction. And certainly a hearing is not required. This court did not order a remand hearing, but at least the Grilly case cited in our brief indicates that the court has discretion. And in a case like this, where there is a complicated record, there's a long history of litigation, there's a live dispute over new evidence, certainly in that context, a hearing would be appropriate.
The thing that troubles me, counsel, is that our last decision in this case indicates very clearly that it is incumbent upon your client to plead the facts and the legal basis and the facts upon which expungement should be ordered. And the petition does not contain the level of detail that you are providing with us today. And so I'm not sure how we reconcile that. I mean, I understand as a matter of, that you've identified some troubling gaps in the record. And I am troubled by the fact that these are knowable things that are absent from the record. But they're not in the petition itself such that the district court is on notice that maybe it should be having a hearing. So it for us to say that the district court abused its discretion given what it had before it seems like a very steep hill for us to climb. Mm-hmm. You want to comment on that?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court was well aware of this dispute following the remand, because there was first a summary denial by the referee. We then sought judge review under 484.77B, and then we appeared in front of Judge Brennan, district court judge, for a review. And all of these arguments, maybe not in the exact detail that was in the appellate brief, but those arguments were brought to the judge's attention, and we explicitly requested a hearing. We raised the issue of the transition of the programs from MPA to MCRO. We added information about the hardships occurring during that coincidental time period. I think we gave enough for the district court to simply find a basis to give us an hour of their time to have somebody come in and testify, set a briefing schedule so you can rule on this. I think there's certainly enough. I agree it wasn't as comprehensive as the 100 pages that we submitted on appeal, but it certainly was enough to warrant a hearing. Briefly, in terms of the constitutional rights side of this, I would just note that there's a context that we're in that lends itself to a ruling from this court on the constitutional rights side of things. There are only three published.
Being brought up the first time on appeal?
No.
This was raised?
This was raised. Yes, Your Honor. We've been arguing about the constitutional rights side of things for now probably 2 years, and I believe in my reply brief, there's a string cite of all of the different portions of our previous submissions that have addressed constitutional rights infringement. I would simply note that given the Supreme Court's transition in the last few months, essentially doing away with the MPA system completely and moving to the MCRO system moving forward, I can't imagine that MCY is going to be the last person who has a dispute over the accuracy of records. And I cannot also imagine that there are going to be others who are subject to the record retention schedule being violated in some respect. So I think that this issue of faulty records or allegedly faulty records is something that has the potential to recur. I think guidance from this court is really important on that front. There are only three published cases concerning constitutional rights violations or alleged constitutional rights violations in the context of a judicial expungement in Minnesota, one from the Supreme Court and two from this court. The Supreme Court in RLF provided the most comprehensive guidance. RLF cited to three out-of-state, out-of-jurisdiction cases One was Doe versus Wheaton out of Maryland. One was Bradford versus Mahan out of Kansas. And the other was Menard versus Saxby out of the D.C. Circuit. Most of the expungement cases dealing with this area of expungement, the constitutional rights infringement, don't get to the issue. RLF didn't get to the issue. And frankly, those three out-of-jurisdiction cases really didn't get to the issue. But what I'd note is that all three of those cases, in some respect, tie into what MCY is facing here, either inaccurate records, the dissemination of records that can't be verified as accurate, and claimed constitutional rights violations related to the right to privacy, due process, equal protection, and the violation of plea agreements. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. As your honors have noted, appellant has filed three expungement petitions since 2019. This is the second time his third petition has come before this court. And this court should affirm the district court's denial of his third petition for the second time because the district court followed this court's remand instructions. It did not abuse its discretion in determining that appellant is ineligible for statutory or inherent authority expungement of his 2006 conviction.
If he dismissed this petition and refiled, would the state be opposing the expungement petition?
That is my first point is on footnote 16 on page 12 of respondent's brief, I did outline that if appellant dismisses and refiles, he would be eligible under this 2023 version of the statute, and I believe that is incorrect, so I do need to correct that portion of my brief.
Wait, did you say it was incorrect?
I said that my footnote is incorrect, so that if appellant dismisses and refiles, it is likely that the district court would deny it again because there wasn't a substantive change in the statute like I had originally read. So that is my apologies to court and counsel for that mistake. So I agree.
It's a little different than my question. My question is, would the state oppose the expungement petition if it were refiled?
That is a good question, Your Honor. I'm not on the expungement team, but it is quite possible. And the reason it's quite possible is because if we look at exactly what happens here with data that the BCA holds, and I will focus on what the BCA holds because it appears that appellant cares primarily about what the BCA holds for the purposes of potential visa implications in the Philippines. So the BCA, criminal records held by the BCA are public records under the Minnesota Data Practices Act, Chapter 13. And they are public for 15 years. So 15 years, the timeline starts upon discharge or the ending of monitoring for a particular sentence. And in this stay of imposition sentence that appellant received in the 2006 file, his sentence was discharged June 30th of 2009, so 15 years is up June 30th, 2024, 5 months from now. And so if my math is mathing, this court has 90 days to issue its opinion. And so if this court rules in appellant's favor, he would essentially save 3 months off of the BCA 15-year timeline under the guidelines. So I just point that out for what it's worth, you know, the stakes of this case. It is very possible that the state would not oppose, but I am not on the expungement team, so I can't say for sure. And I don't want to misrepresent something to the court. So hopefully that answers your question. I did want to first correct my brief and then touch on sort of the stakes that Your Honor is understanding. But again, with regard to the stakes, the question before this court is, did the district court abuse its discretions in the ways that appellant is now complaining about on appeal? That is separate from the practical considerations of the timelines, of the circumstances of appellant's individual life. Those are sort of separate. The main question before this court is, was there an abuse of discretion in the ways that appellant is arguing? And the answer is no, there was not an abuse of discretion. I'd like to touch on the statutory expungement claim and the sort of counter arguments that respondent makes, briefly touch on inherent authority, and then again discuss some of the sort of practical implications of this case. Your Honors, there has been no abuse of discretion by the district court in denying appellant's petition for statutory expungement, and for two different reasons that the state outlines in its brief. First, the plain language of the statute does not list offering a forged check in the expungement statute. It lists only check forgery and then lists generally, links generally to the statute, the criminal statute for offering a forged check. And there is additional support for that that I can lay out this morning. And that is, if you look at 609A02, subdivision 3A8, which then asks you to look at subdivision 3B, which lists all those eligible statutory offenses. That's where sort of the crux of the argument is. If you look at B35, the felony check forgery less than $2,500 is eligible for expungement. But in that parens, where it describes check forgery, it does not list offering a forged check, which is a distinct statutory offense, criminal offense. And if this court would look a little bit below B35 and B38, the legislature did clearly title the parens, the sort of explanatory portion, in the same way that the statute it links to is titled, meaning that title includes all of the specific offenses listed in the 609 statute. And it could have done so for B35. It could have included check forgery, semicolon, offering a forged check, and it simply did not. So that is the crux of the state's argument there.
It troubles me about this.
Sure.
The way the pleas went down.
The pleas?
The pleas, in this case. They're both done at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And the one count in which the amount was over the statutory amount that prevents expungement seems, as a matter of common sense, would have been reduced to an amount under the statutory limit the way the pleas were made. Because the other offense, it seems to me, was the was kind of the catalyst for the deal, for the plea. In other words, the one that was where he actually had an amount that was under the $2,500, correct?
Well, Your Honor, may I push back?
Yeah.
What I hear you saying is that in the practical considerations, when two parties are approaching a potential plea agreement, they're talking about the two offenses, and this one's more serious, and then this one could run concurrent, run at the same time,
yep.
And that's fine. That discussion is a practical discussion, but legally speaking, the concurrent to X does not mean that one is necessarily more serious than the other if you're looking
Except
at the plea agreement.
When you don't have a record of what actually happened.
Oh, sure. But, Your Honor, the second way I can push back on that is if we're thinking practically about what happened at this plea hearing, we are looking at an 05 file and an 06 file. So the 05 file is resolved, it is expunged, and I won't get into the details of that. But for the 06 file, what we have here is one single check for over $2,500. I've seen the check, Your Honor, it exists. It's outside the record, but it exists. I've laid eyes on it and I have a copy in my file. The check exists, I've seen it. So what we have here is the complaint that alleges this amount. It is a single count and it is a single check. So I don't see a reality where a prosecutor would then claim that this appellant offered a check less than what the check was submitted for. And I can see in a practical consideration, let's say there were two checks involved, or let's say there were two counts. Prosecutor could dismiss one count and then still have the validity of that other check. But what we have here is appellant is claiming the prosecutor looked at this check for over $2,700, nearly $2,800, and said, actually, that check is for less than $2,500. That's a lie. And I don't foresee a reality where that would have happened at a plea hearing. So that is my common sense approach of what actually could have occurred at that hearing. I would never have done that. And so, again.
But the plea petition would have cleared that up, wouldn't it?
Potentially. Potentially, and thank you for bringing up the plea petition. Back in the day, when I was clerking in district court, plea petitions were executed by carbon copy. There should have been a million copies of this plea petition, and appellant himself would have received a carbon copy of that. It should have been pink or yellow, if I'm remembering the colors correctly. So plea petitions should exist in many forms and by many holders, including the district court in this case, clearly. But appellant, too, should have had his own copy in appellant's counsel, perhaps. And again, we're talking a plea in 2006, so I believe that is the practice. You know, is that fact something considered by the district court? You know, I can't be sure here, but as a practical for what it's worth consideration, if we're thinking about what happened in 2006, that is likely what happened. And so for what it's worth. And regard to the state's argument for against statutory expungement, the monetary amount fight that is regarding the plea petition and what appellant alleges happened at the plea hearing, what that comes down to in this case is it's appellant's burden as petitioner of his expungement to prove by clear and convincing evidence what he believes happened at the 2006 plea hearing. That's the only way he prevails on statutory expungement. And so what we have here is, let's say the notation is wrong in Mensis. The district court still would not believe appellant's version of events there. The notation could be an incorrect addition. It doesn't mean that it's wrong factually as to what happened in 2006. And the way that you get to that conclusion is by believing appellant or by having appellant call people who were at the hearing, the prosecutor, the probation officer.
The judge.
The judge. There's other people who could lend credibility there, and appellant didn't do that. I assume the appellant didn't bring the probation officer because, according to publicly available documents, he was supervised by the felony probation officer. But there are other ways he could bolster his credibility there. And I'll note that on this standard of review, and also the review standard that Judge Brennan had to employ when reviewing the denial order, those credibility determinations are due great deference, and for good reason. It's Referee Reed who was the one who observed appellant's demeanor as he was giving his arguments and testimony, I think in 2021 at that initial hearing. And I'll also note that...
So, the argument today is on remand, he wanted another hearing, an evidentiary hearing, and it's your position that if he wanted to present this evidence of what happened at the 2006, in the plea hearing for the 2006 case, that it was incumbent upon him to subpoena these witnesses at the hearing that was originally before Referee Reed.
In 2021?
Yes.
Yes. This is many bites of the apple is another way to say that. And I'll also...
Shot.
Correct, okay. Since 2019. And again, for what it's worth, the BCA records will be sealed in 5 months anyways. But it is important to note that Referee Reed did not just see appellant one time at one hearing. These particular judges and referees have been seeing appellant for many years now. So they're aware of how to assess his credibility. And that credibility or incredibility determination is due great deference on review, as this court's already aware. I can briefly touch on the inherent authority arguments that the state makes in its brief, and I just want to note at the outset that inherent authority expungement of records held by an executive branch agency is so rare, I have not seen it in Minnesota, not aware of any case, where based on a constitutional rights infringement, this court has demanded the executive branch agency, like the BCA, to seal it. I have not seen any. And so that's how rare it is. That's how an extraordinary remedy it is. And so there's a few problems where appellant just can't make that hurdle to get to that outcome in this case. And what the phrase here that this court is concerned with is there a serious infringement of a constitutional right? And in this case, appellant does not have a constitutional right to particular notations or the lack of a document retained, however accidentally, by the judiciary. There's no right to that. On the flip side, there is a right to public dissemination of records held by the BCA, at least for 15 years. So there's no recognizable constitutional right at issue. And then the second part of that phrase that this court is concerned about is there a serious infringement? Whether it's a clerical error notation or the lack of, at least the district court retaining of the plea agreement, the signed plea agreement, which appellant presumably would have as well. That is not a serious infringement. A serious infringement under substantive due process, equal protection, privacy, has to do with a deprivation of, you know, life, liberty, property, those types of things. And so because there's no recognizable constitutional right, and this infringement is not as great as what you would see in, especially in the foreign cases cited by appellant on appeal and at the district court, it's just not the same. It's highly distinguishable. And so for here, there is no injustice that occurred warranting the extreme remedy of sealing the executive branch records in this case that are held by the BCA. If I may just have one moment with my 44 seconds. Oh, I do want to touch briefly on the alleged breach of a plea agreement. I see no basis in the record for that, for the same reasons as I discussed with Judge Smith, the practical implications of what happened at the, what likely happened at the 2006 hearing. And I also believe, based on my reading of the statutes, felonies were not expungible before 2015. So I'm not sure how that would have been part of a plea agreement in 2006. And opposing counsel can fact check me if I got that part of the expungement statute incorrect as well, but I believe that is the case. It would not have been part of the plea agreement, and the state did not renege. My time has expired. I respectfully ask this court affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I've got a few points in rebuttal. The first is I direct the court to page 6 of our principal brief, footnote number 3. There's discussion during opposing counsel's argument over all of the other things that this appellant could have done to try to track down this record. He did all of the things that this court noted. He contacted Hennepin County Attorney's Office. They would not respond to him. He tried contacting his defense attorney who represented him at the time. His defense attorney had passed the year mark for how long the ethics rules require him to keep the file. He didn't have the file anymore. He contacted the BCA. I also contacted the BCA. BCA doesn't have records. The BCA relies on fingerprinting information and the court records that are available, i.e. the complaint. So he did all of those things, short of subpoenaing the judge or the probation officer. I suppose he didn't subpoena a probation officer. But he engaged in significant efforts long before any of this in order to prove this point. The second thing, the idea that he has an obligation at the 2021 hearing to subpoena the witnesses related to the dispute over the accuracy of this notation, that's not sound reasoning. We didn't know that there was a notation that was non-public until oral argument in this case years later. So the idea that when he filed his initial expungement petition, he should have subpoenaed the technical lead worker for Hennepin County to show up and testify makes no sense because we didn't know there was a dispute over that. All of the records that we were able to obtain didn't indicate one way or another for sure whether he was eligible or not, but the records that we were able to obtain did lend itself to the idea that he was eligible. And those were the sentencing order and the warrant of commitment, which indicated, as Your Honor pointed out, that you have a more serious offense that was charged as a more serious offense running concurrent with an offense that was less serious. It makes far more sense, contrary to opposing counsel's position, that there was a plea agreement, and the plea agreement was resolved with both files sentenced under the same subdivision. You pled to both, and that happens all the time. You have individuals who committed a felony theft, but they plead and are sentenced under a subdivision for something other than a felony. That happens both due to factual innocence, but it also happens just in the matter of normal course of business. To obviate the need for a trial, to obviate the loss of resources, there are plenty of reasons why plea negotiations like that happen. And that's absolutely possibly what could have happened here, and that is what appellant has been saying did happen here since the very beginning. We have never disputed that there's the check. We've never disputed that he was charged with offering a forged check. But what's different between the more serious offering a forged check offense and the offense that we know was sentenced under the lower subdivision is that he received a computer in that one. That was an actual theft, loss of a computer. Here, offering a forged check, he was caught. There was no computer that was obtained. So in that respect, even though the loss amount was more serious under the offense that we know was eligible for statutory expungement. Here, we're dealing with something that's illusory. We're dealing with him writing a check. That's far different than actually stealing, actually obtaining property. So that's the second point. The third point, I direct the court to the second page, or paginated as number two, of our reply brief. Opposing counsel made this argument that the offense to which Mr. MCY pled is not eligible for statutory expungement because it's a check forgery, or rather, it's an offering a forged check conviction versus a check forgery conviction. They're relying on a parenthetical description in the 609A expungement statute. Looking directly to the subdivision that opposing counsel referenced, which is 609A.02 subdivision 3B32, it references the sentencing provision that is applicable to both offering a forged check and check forgery. So simply because there's a descriptive parenthetical, that's not important. The statutory citation is what's important. And the expungement statute references that it is that offenses are eligible if they are sentenced under that subdivision. Not this, it doesn't reference the offense of check forgery. It doesn't reference the offense of offering a forged check. It references the loss amount sentencing subdivision applicable to both of those offenses. So the parenthetical is unimportant. It's a descriptor. It's helpful in terms of argument, but it's not binding. And there's case law that indicates that descriptive parentheticals shouldn't govern when there's an explicit statutory citation. Look at the statute. Don't rely on another statute's citation and descriptive parenthetical of what that other statute contains. Just go directly to the statute.
Your time has expired. I assume that you've concluded your remarks.
I did. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. And thank you to both counsel for appearing today and arguing in support of your briefing and your client's position. The matter is submitted, and a decision will be issued in the 90-day schedule.